time. Oh, okay, now we've kind of forgotten this. In all this time, have you had any contact with Jack Egan ever since he walked in your office and said, hi, I'm Egan?
Yeah, now let's
see.
Can
I use your phone? Great line.
Yeah, isn't that I always remind him of that, too. He stuck out your hand and said, my name's Egan, can I use your phone? Now, he's a person that used to come to Washington for our meetings of one kind or another. I remember seeing him a number of times when I was there, and we'd go out to dinner or something. Or, like the meeting I was talking to you about that was out at CU, I think he was at that meeting.
He had to get some from high on Egan to taking you out to dinner. There had to be something to go on in between.
Well, let's see. Where
so when you were at the Catholic Interracial Council, did you remember?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
You were part of the whole community.
Of course, yeah. See,
but
and all through this, you met at the John A. Ryan Forums March, and, you know, parties and, I don't know, parties exactly, meetings. There would be things going on, you know. I ran into him in a lot of situations. And of course at St. Bennett's.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much at Mundelein or anything, but I still used to see the people. I'd come down and have dinner with Nina and Teresa and some of the St. Bennett folks and stuff like that. And then from CIC, now his office was just down the street from us, you know. They were at 720 Rush, and we were 21 West Superior. So, I think really see one another more at meetings, and we were sort of traveling in the same groups,
mm-hmm.
but not working directly together.
Then,
yeah.
So then it was natural that when you come to Washington, that you run into them.
Yeah. Or he'd call up and say he was coming or something like that. And I used to write to him from Washington, and he'd write back, you know, about what was going on. So
you really were developing a friendship all the time.
Uh-huh.
And you weren't writing to everybody.
No. But I guess in those earlier days, I can't... and I don't know exactly how to say it, that John A. Ryan Forum was the gathering place where you met everybody. Really and truly, where you really did meet everybody. Now, I can remember saying to the first time I was out to Dan and Sheila Daly's call to action thing, and I said to Dan, this is the closest thing I've seen to the John A. Ryan Forum, which was so key in my own, you know, kind of formation and understanding and friendship with all the people who were doing things. So if you can kind of get that in your head, if you never went to the John A. Ryan Forum, think of yourself going to the call to action conferences.
Yeah, and everybody you ever knew is there.
They're all there, and you have to meet, and you have to talk, and you meet this one and that one, and you all have dinner, and you care about the same people and the same issues. And all. That's what that John A. Ryan Forum gang was like, you know, and there'd always be 400 or 500 people at those things, but there'd always be that inner core of folks, you know, who were at all of them.
Like-minded folks.
But it really was an important kind of vehicle, I think, for us in those days. Yeah.
And there has to be something.
I can remember saying that to Dan Daly, because he didn't really know it. I think he was too young, or maybe he was in the seminary or something. But he knew about it, you know. And I said to him, "This is what the John A. Ryan Forum is for." Pulling the gang together.
Okay, so then, is there going to be a relationship between what you're doing here and getting in the contract buyer's seat?
Well, see, now, when I'm back here, now Jack's out at presentation now, at this point, I think. 65. Yeah, I think he went out there in 65. So that when I came back and was working for NCCIJ, there's still some contact. In fact, this is at the point where, in a sense, we sort of start Sikkim.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Because there was one of the things that Matt offered to do. Kind of do the service for a group. They were mostly priests, and it was the old convert making association of priests that worked in the black community, and they had a new name for it, and they were going to meet in Evanston. I'd have to go back and find out the name of that group, but it was sort of changing its focus from more than convert making by those priests who were working in the black community to the more general living conditions of people in the inner cities, and we were doing the legwork for that. Like, we set up the meeting and worked out the mailing and all that kind of stuff. And Jack called because he knew a lot of people who were coming into that meeting, and he wanted to get some of those folks together. He wanted to piggyback on that meeting to get a number of those priests together who had some interest in community organization. And it was the Paul Rins from Boston and David Finks from Rochester, New York. And there were a couple of guys out of Detroit and somebody else from Cleveland and Pat Flood from Milwaukee and a few more. But they were all coming in to this other meeting. And he wanted to invite them in the day before, to piggyback on that, invite them in the day before and see if he could get this group together, because they had just set up this organization called the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization in New York. And they had to have, in order to get a seat on that board, they had to have $1,000 and a Catholic organization. And the NCWC in Washington wouldn't touch it. So his idea was, if you could pull out the people in the various dioceses who were interested in the subject, that maybe they could form some kind of an organization, and that among themselves they could ante up the $1,000 and they get a seat on this board, see, for this group in New York. So we set up he wrote the letter and everything, and which people he wanted to get it and all that. Then we made the arrangements for the meeting up there at Orrington. And I remember Gino Baroni coming out of this room and saying, oh my God, we've just formed another Catholic organization. And they called it the Catholic Committee for Community Organization. And among themselves, they anteed up the $1,000 to get a seat on this board. And that's how the thing started. Mm. And then we did another meeting. We did a meeting the next year in Detroit, and they did the same thing. And they piggybacked on that one and brought this same group of folks in again. And I think it was at that.
Oops. Oh, my God. Oh.
At that meeting that they changed it to urban ministry.
Let myself be diverted.
That they changed the name of the thing to Catholic Committee on Urban Ministry.
Oh, this is before you ever got to Notre Dame.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Yeah. So that thing was really in place. You know, they only met once a year, and it was just these 20 people or something like that, you know. And the reason that it was formed to begin with was to get a seat on this board, because it was organizational membership only.
Right.
It's the only way they could do it. So.
And what did that senior board do?
What they were trying to do at that point was, there had been, this is around the time of, you know, Stokely Carmichael mm-hmm. going to the churches and asking for reparations, you know, Episcopalians, you owe me $20 million mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. What they were trying to do was to set up an inter-religious vehicle that would receive and disperse funds for community organization work, and who also would have a responsibility for some kind of evaluation of those organizations.
Grant funds or federal funds?
No, they'd be church grant funds. Like instead of the diocese of whatever granting that and not knowing maybe really what that organization's really like or what they're going to be doing. You want somebody to, you know, kind of check them out and be sure that they're bona fide to start with, and then are they follow up on it? Did they do what they said they were going to do with the money and all that kind of stuff? That's what they were looking for, some kind of a vehicle outside of that, so that every single religious group wasn't being hit by the same folks or different folks, but that there was one place to which you came if you were looking for funds, and that there were certain criteria of organization and your work and evaluation and all the rest of it. That was the original intention of what they were trying to do.
Oh, so now we've got Stephen on the board. Okay, and Jack did that with Matt.
Yeah, but that was down around in here, 66 or, in there. And then in here, too, is when I started doing stuff for him out at Prez.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, how did you? Oh, so and this grew naturally. He went out to Prez, and then...
Yeah, he was already out there. See, when I came back.
And so this grew out of the relationship that you already had, and you went back and forth to New York.
Yeah, right. So then I started going out there and doing some work for him on the week, like on the weekends.
And that's in 66 and 68. Mm-hmm. And the same sort of thing, the mail thing.
Yes,
and
right.
Answering his mail and organizing and stuff.
Yeah.
But you weren't already going to church there.
Well, I guess I was, because that's when I would, I always remember bringing the stuff back there on Sunday morning. So I must have been...
It was really very good of you to work all week and then go out there and do it on Saturday.
Well, I guess it wasn't a really big deal.
Was it fun?
Yeah. And I don't know that there was... I mean, it always made it like it was an impossible sort of situation. So, well, if you organize it a little bit, then it won't be so bad, you know? Put all these papers together, so having all those stacks of stuff, you know? So we just sort of organize them, and then he'd write little one-liners, you know, well, you can zip those off in no time. And a lot of them were one-liners, but he answered everything. And he still does.
And answers all his mail.
All his mail. He even answers Save the Whales mail sometimes. You know, all that third-class stuff. But if he reads it and finds it interesting, he writes and tells him. You know?
Oh, does he? And he sends him a contribution.
But if it's one-liners, you know, you can do those real fast.
It'd be interesting to know what percentage of the money that he has he sends off like that. He's always sending somebody money.
Oh, gosh. He doesn't do much. I mean, he just keeps sending, well, I'll tell you this. When, is it the last couple of years? I don't know how this man figures out all his taxes, but you're only allowed, I think in the last 2 years, a certain amount that, maybe it's a percentage that you can deduct for charitable purposes. He's been over that twice. And the IRS comes back and wants more tax money because he was $300 over what
you're allowed
for charitable contributions, and so
he
can't count that, and he has to pay more taxes, and it's cost him about $150 each time. Crazy, huh?
He really is
very generous, but it is so interesting that I always remember Florence Jankowski saying, bread cast upon the waters doesn't always come back soggy. Sometimes it comes back a ham sandwich. Well, he gets, I think because of, he is generous, you know, he'll get checks just right out of the blue. You know, just a little gift for you, Father. And so he, somehow or another, he's never all the way broke, you know?
Mm.
Something else comes along.
So he gets by.
Yeah, he gets by
he
very well.
He has enough money to run, drive his car and all that sort of thing. Oh, so okay, so here in 66 to 68, you're already trotting out to presentation. You're already going to church there. You're already used to the neighborhood. You weren't scared going to the neighborhood?
No. Well, I only went to, you know, in daylight time most of the time.
Mm.
And then I also met, I think, at the rectory, I must have met Jack McNamara. Then I did a couple of things for him on my trusty old typewriter down there.
For Jack McNamara,
who was beginning the Contract Buyers League.
He's the Jesuit scholastic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. He was the one who was kind of working with the folks to get that organized.
Well, Peggy, speaking of the turmoil, this is 66 to 68, when you went out there, did it seem that there was a lot of turmoil?
No, not really. I mean, the only time I remember it, Marge, is I was at NCCIJ, the day all the fires started out in Lawndale.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, I think we were on the sixth floor there, something like that. Fifth or sixth. From our windows there, you could see all the smoke out that way. And you know, I guess we had TV set on or something like that, and kept wondering if, you know, any of the folks that we knew out there were okay and all that kind of stuff. And I can remember going home that night, going down Michigan Avenue, I think, and then the outer drive, and how crowded it was, like everybody was trying to get back home to wherever they belonged, you know, and not be out in the street or something.
Mm.
And I have a recollection, I think there was somebody who worked in our office who was on some special medication, and she had to go to a drugstore around the Drake Hotel, or maybe it was even in the Drake Hotel. And I said I'd take her. And before she went home, because everybody was saying they didn't know how long this was going to last, you know, and if you got home and stay there, and do you have enough groceries to last you for a couple of days and that kind of stuff. You know. And her concern was this medication that she had to take. And there was a special place where she had to get it. And it was whether it was in the Drake or close to the Drake or something. Anyhow, I remember taking her there to get the medicine and then coming north. and how crowded the outer drive was, you know, trying to get home.
Now, were you but driving was, or in the bus? Or?
No, I was driving. I was driving. I think I was, I was driving at that point. And then dropped her off someplace, like her home or something, and went home. But that was the only time that I remember the real turmoil was when all that news came up, that everything was starting to burn.
Now, did you share in that general turmoil of all those people at presentation whose lives were upended?
No, I don't think so. See, because when I went out there, I worked with McNamara, but we worked out of, he had an apartment on Independence Boulevard, and we used the dining room of that apartment as sort of like an office.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the typewriter and all that was. And then when we got a little bigger, we went to a storefront on Pulaski. And we had a regular office set up then in the storefront. So, and they had the meetings every Wednesday night of the Contract Buyers League people was at the parish in the school hall. But other than that, we were in that office rather than in the parish property, except for the Wednesday night meeting.
So on Wednesday night, you had to leave the neighborhood in the dark, though.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But everybody was around then, you know, there were lots of folks there. It was, it never seemed
like
anything.
None of his jobs was to pay very much.
No, I don't think so.
That's one of the points that Kathy McNamara, or Kathy, you call it, Moriarty made. That nobody who was involved in presentation at that time or any time since has made any money. Well, was it what they had in mind?
Yeah, No, they didn't move from there to make big money, that's for sure.
Right.
Yeah. Jack Hill is doing rehab housing in South Bend.
Oh, is that what he's doing?
Gilligan, I don't know what Gilligan is. He's probably better off than most of them. I think he's in some kind of development work in Milwaukee. But, you know, Kathy's still teaching. Mary Dowling's still teaching, I think.
Yeah, she said she's still at the learning. Okay, so then, so you're going out in St. Jack on weekends, and then how did...
Well, then I met McNamara, at Prez, and then he started talking about needing somebody full-time out there, and that's when I went out in 68, went out to, I said to Matt, this, maybe it's the national organization thing is what's not working for me now. I mean, I need to get kind of grassrootsy, you know, how you need that, and then you can go back, and I said to him, I think that's what I really need, and I think I'm going to go off to Lawndale and work with the CBL people. And that's what I did. And then, interestingly enough, a couple of years later, Matt Ammon went to work for the Diocese of San Antonio, Texas. And he said to me, I'm taking a leaf from your book. He said, I need to get more back to the grassroots. Yeah. And then he left that national thing, and he worked for 3 or 4 years at in that local diocese of San Antonio.
Oh.
But he understood what I was saying there about the national thing was just, it was too too cerebral or something for me at that point, and I needed some grounding.
So, the Contract Buyer League or something you could really get
to. Yeah.
Ooh, okay, Peggy. So Jack McNamara asked you to come out, and you decided to. And so now you're driving from Rogers down to Independence Boulevard.
Yeah.
And describe the Contract Buyer League.
Well, honestly, those people were just, they were really marvelous.
Oh, wait. Oh, I heard a noise.
Stop?
No, it was the door. I thought it was the door. Almost.
They really were a marvelous group of people. there were four black people who were also paid staff people in CBL by the time we moved to that storefront place. Charlie Baker, Clyde Ross, uh-huh, Henrietta Banks, and Ruth Wells.
Is this Clyde Ross that came out to this plane? Doesn't it? No, that's a video. Clyde Brooks. Okay. Mm.
And for the most part, they worked a lot with the buyer people. They'd look over their contracts and try and figure out. They worked a lot with individual groups that were all buying from the same person. Like they would always say to you, "Who's your seller?"
Mm.
So that what they found out there was that there were probably 20 or so real estate people who had bought up series of properties.
Mm.
So there might be 20 families who were all buying from you, 30 families who were buying from this guy, 25 families who were buying for those, and that's the way they organized them, saying, "Who's your seller?" Was that part of it. And then they'd go through the contract. And McNamara and Joe Putnick and a few more, those were the people who researched the properties. They'd come down to the county building and really check the history of the building, who had it and how much did they sell it for, and then it changed hands here and cost this, and then, to get the regular history of the of the property and what the costs were. And then they would set up these case studies about what was happening currently with that piece of property. And the contract, they had been told by any number of people that they didn't have a chance on this issue because it was legal.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, it may be legal, but it's immoral what's going on. And so the idea was to put the pressure on to get those contracts renegotiated so that people would be treated fairly. And I've got some stuff in the files at Notre Dame. These are some of these case studies that they used. And they'd give you the background. Jack McNamara used to write these up. The background of the family. And that the property was sold for to a speculator for $14,000, and he sells to the black family for $25,000 or $30,000 on contract. And of course, you have to buy your insurance from the seller.
So nobody else will give you any.
Well, they won't give you any, and of course, you have to have it insured because nothing belongs to you until you make the final payment on the contract. You know. And it was a terrible thing what those people were having to go through. It was just, it really was awful. But by banding together, they were a real force, you know, at some point.